The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the sixth reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna. I'm Anna McLean. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. It is October now and chilly. Everything was in short supply. Captain Beck asked Rianne for a list of Jews, communists, homosexuals, Freemasons, and Jehovah Witnesses, and assures her it is merely clerical. She gives him a list which includes her friend Rachel. The next day, several teachers, including Rachel, are dismissed. Meanwhile, Isabel sets out every morning to distribute tracts printed by the resistance. She needs a bicycle to make the job easier and finally sees one by the cafe where the Germans are having breakfast. Now we continue with The Nightingale. That was when she saw it, a bright silver bicycle leaning against the side wall of the cafe. At the sight of it, she thought how much it would change her life, ease her pain, to ride to town and back each day. Normally, a bicycle would be guarded by the soldiers in the cafe, but on this snow-dusted morning, no one was outside at a table. Don't do it. Her heart started beating quickly. Her palms turned damp and hot within her mittens. She glanced around. The women queued up at the butcher's, made it a point to see nothing and make eye contact with no one. The windows of the cafe across the street were fogged. Inside, the men were olive-hued silhouettes. So certain of themselves. Of us, she thought bitterly. At that, whatever sliver of restraint she possessed disappeared. She held the basket close to her side and limped out onto the ice-licked cobblestone street. From that second, that one step forward, the world seemed to blur around her and time slowed down. She heard her breath, saw the plumes of it in front of her face. The buildings blurred or faded into white hulks. The snow dazzled until all she could see was the glint of the silver handlebars and the two black tires. She knew there was only one way to do this, fast, without a glance sideways or a pause in her step. Somewhere a dog barked. A door banged shut. Isabel kept walking. Five steps separated her from the bicycle. Four. Three. Two. She stepped up onto the sidewalk and took hold of the bicycle and jumped onto it. She rode down the cobblestone street, the chassis clanging at bumps in the road. She skidded around the corner, almost fell, and righted herself, pedaling hard toward Rue La Grande. There, she turned into the alley and jumped off the bicycle to knock on the door. Four hard clacks. The door opened slowly. Henri saw her and frowned. She pushed her way inside. The small meeting room was barely lit. A single oil lamp sat on a scarred wooden table. Henri was the only one here. He was making sausage from a tray of meat and fat. Skeins of it hung from hooks on the wall. The room smelled of meat and blood and cigarette smoke. She yanked the bicycle in with her and slammed the door shut. "Well, hello," he said, wiping his hands on a towel. "Have we called a meeting I don't know about?" "No." He glanced at her side. "That's not your bicycle." "I stole it," she said, "from right under their noses. It is, or was, Alain Deschamps' bicycle. He left everything and fled to Lyon with his family when the occupation began." Henri moved toward her. "Lately, I have seen an SS soldier riding it around town." "SS?" Isabel's elation faded. There were ugly rumors swirling about the SS and their cruelty. Perhaps she should have thought this through. He moved closer, so close she could feel the warmth of his body. She had never been alone with him before, nor so near him. She saw for the first time that his eyes were neither brown nor green, but rather a hazel gray that made her think of a fog in a deep forest. She saw a small scar at his brow that had either been a terrible gash at one time or poorly stitched, and it made her wonder all at once what kind of life he'd led that had brought him here and to communism. He was older than she by at least a decade, although, to be honest, he seemed even older sometimes, as if perhaps he'd suffered a great loss. "You'll need to paint it," he said. "I don't have any paint." "I do." "Would you?" "A kiss," he said. "A kiss?" She repeated it to stall for time. This was the sort of thing that she'd taken for granted before the war. Men desired her. They always had. She wanted that back, wanted to flirt with Henri and be flirted with, and yet the very idea of it felt sad and a little lost, as if perhaps kisses didn't mean much anymore and flirtation even less. One kiss, and I'll paint your bicycle tonight, and you can pick it up tomorrow. She stepped toward him and tilted her face up to his. They came together easily, even with all the coats and layers of newsprint and wool between them. He took her in his arms and kissed her. For a beautiful second, she was Isabel Rossignol, again the passionate girl whom men desired. When it ended and he drew back, she felt deflated, sad. She should say something, make a joke, or perhaps pretend that she felt more than she did. That's what she would have done before, when kisses had meant more, or maybe less. "There's someone else," Henri said, studying her intently. "No, there isn't." Henri touched her cheek gently. "You're lying." Isabel thought of all that Henri had given her. He was the one who'd brought her into the Free French Network and given her a chance. He was the one who believed in her. And yet, when he kissed her, she thought of Gaetan. "He didn't want me," she said. It was the first time she'd told anyone the truth. The admission surprised her. "If things were different, I'd make you forget him. And I'd let you try." She saw the way he smiled at that, saw the sorrow in it. "Blue," he said after a pause. "Blue? It's the paint color I have." Isabel smiled. "How fitting." Later that day, as she stood in one line after another for too little food, and then as she gathered wood from the forest and carried it home, she thought about that kiss. What she thought, over and over again, was, "If only." Chapter 13. On a beautiful day in late April 1941, Isabel lay stretched out on a woolen blanket in the field across from the house. The sweet smell of ripening hay filled her nostrils. When she closed her eyes, she could almost forget that the engines in the distance were German lorries taking soldiers and France's produce to the train station at Tours. After the disastrous winter, she appreciated how sunshine on her face lulled her into a drowsy state. "There you are." Isabel sighed and sat up. Vianne wore a faded blue gingham day dress that had been grayed by harsh homemade soap. Hunger had whittled her down over the winter, sharpened her cheekbones, and deepened the hollow at the base of her throat. An old scarf turbaned her head, hiding hair that had lost its shine and curl. "This came for you." Vianne held out a piece of paper. "It was delivered by a man. For you," she said, as if that fact bore repeating. Isabel clambered awkwardly to her feet and snatched the paper from Vianne's grasp. On it, in scrawled handwriting, was, "The curtains are open." She reached down for her blanket and began folding it up. What did it mean? They'd never summoned her before. Something important must be happening. "Isabel, would you care to explain?" "No." "It was Henri Navarre, the innkeeper's son. I didn't think you knew him." Isabel ripped the note into tiny pieces and let it fall away. "He is a communist, you know," Vianne said in a whisper. "I need to go." Vianne grabbed her wrist. "You cannot have been sneaking out all winter to see a communist. You know what the Nazis think of them. It's dangerous to even be seen with this man." "You think I care what the Nazis think?" Isabel said, wrenching free. She ran barefooted across the field. At home, she grabbed some shoes and climbed aboard her bicycle. With an au revoir to a stunned-looking Vianne, Isabel was off, pedaling down the dirt road. In town, she coasted past the abandoned hat shop. Sure enough, the curtains were open, and veered into the cobblestone alley and came to a stop. She leaned her bicycle against the rough limestone wall beside her and rapped four times. It didn't occur to her until the final knock that it might be a trap. The idea, when it came, made her draw in a sharp breath and glance left and right, but it was too late now. Henri opened the door. Isabel ducked inside. The room was hazy with cigarette smoke and reeked of burned chicory coffee. There was about the place a lingering scent of blood, sausage-making. The burly man who had first grabbed her, Didier, was seated on an old hickory-backed chair. He was leaning back so far the two front chair legs were off the floor and his back grazed the wall behind him. You shouldn't have brought a notice to my house, Henri. My sister is asking questions. It was important we talk to you immediately. Isabel felt a little bump of excitement. Would they finally ask her to do something more than dropping papers in letter boxes? I am here. Henri lit up a cigarette. She could feel him watching her as he exhaled the gray smoke and put down his match. Have you heard of a prefect in Chartres who was arrested and tortured for being a communist? Isabel frowned. No. He cut his own throat with a piece of glass rather than name anyone or confess. Henri snubbed his cigarette out on the bottom of his shoe and saved the rest for later in his coat pocket. He is putting a group together of people like us who want to heed de Gaulle's call. He, the one who cut his own throat, is trying to get to London to speak to de Gaulle himself. He seeks to organize a free French movement. He didn't die, Isabel asked, or cut his vocal cords? No, they're calling it a miracle, Didier said. Henri studied Isabel. I have a letter, very important, that needs to be delivered to our contact in Paris. Unfortunately, I am being watched closely these days, as is Didier. Oh, Isabel said. I thought of you, Didier said. Me? Henri reached into his pocket and withdrew a crumpled envelope. Will you deliver this to our man in Paris? He is expecting it a week from today. But I don't have an Ausweis. Oui, Henri said quietly. And if you were caught, he let that threat dangle. Certainly no one would think badly of you if you declined. This is dangerous. Dangerous was an understatement. There were signs posted throughout Carreau about executions that were taking place all over the occupied zone. The Nazis were killing French citizens for the smallest of infractions. Aiding this free French movement could get her imprisoned at the very least. Still, she believed in a free France the way her sister believed in God. So you want me to get a pass, go to Paris, deliver a letter, and come home? It didn't sound so perilous when put that way. No, Henri said. We need you to stay in Paris and be our letterbox, as it were. In the coming months, there will be many such deliveries. Your father has an apartment there, oui? Paris. It was what she'd longed for from the moment her father had exiled her. To leave Carreau and return to Paris and be part of a network of people who resisted this war. My father will not offer me a place to stay. Convince him otherwise, Didier said evenly, watching her, judging her. He is not a man who is easily convinced, she said. So you can't do it. Voila, we have our answer. Wait, Isabel said. Henri approached her. She saw reluctance in his eyes and knew that he wanted her to turn down this assignment. No doubt he was worried about her. She lifted her chin and looked him in the eyes. I will do this. You will have to lie to everyone you love and always be afraid. Can you live that way? You will not feel safe anywhere. Isabel laughed grimly. It was not so different from the life she'd lived since she was a little girl. Will you watch over my sister? She asked Henri. Make sure she's safe? There is a price for all our work, Henri said. He gave her a sad look. In it was the truth they had all learned. There was no safety. I hope you see that. All Isabel saw was a chance to do something that mattered. When do I leave? As soon as you get an Ausweis, which will not be easy. What in heaven's name is that girl thinking? Really, a schoolyard-style note from a man? A communist? Vianne unwrapped the stringy piece of mutton that had been this week's ration and set it on the kitchen counter. Isabel had always been impetuous, a force of nature, really, a girl who liked to break rules. Countless nuns and teachers had learned that she could be neither controlled nor contained. But this was not kissing a boy on the dance floor or running away to see the circus or refusing to wear a girdle and stockings. This was wartime in an occupied country. How could Isabel still believe that her choices had no consequences? Vianne began finally chopping the mutton. She added a precious egg to the mix and stale bread, then seasoned it with salt and pepper. She was forming the mixture into patties when she heard a motorcycle putt-puttering toward the house. She went to the front door and opened it just enough to peer out. Captain Beck's head and shoulders could be seen above the stone wall as he dismounted his motorcycle. Moments later, a green military lorry pulled up behind him and parked. Three other German soldiers appeared in her yard. The men talked among themselves and then gathered at the rose-covered stone wall her great-grandfather had built. One of the soldiers lifted a sledgehammer and brought it down hard on the wall, which shattered. Stones broke into pieces. A skein of roses fell, their pink petals scattering across the grass. Vianne rushed out into her yard. "Herr Capitan!" The sledgehammer came down again. Crack! "Madame," Beck said, looking unhappy. It bothered Vianne that she knew him well enough to notice his state of mind. "We have orders to tear down all the walls along this road." As one soldier demolished the wall, two others came toward the front door, laughing at some joke between them. Without asking permission, they walked past her and went into her house. "My condolences," Beck said, stepping over the rubble on his way to her. "I know you love the roses. And most sorrowfully, my men will be fulfilling a requisition order from your house." "A requisition?" The soldiers came out of the house. One carried the oil painting that had been over the mantel, and the other had the overstuffed chair from the salon. "That was my grandmère's favorite chair," Vianne said quietly. "I'm sorry," Beck said. "I was unable to stop this." "What in the world?" Vianne didn't know whether to be relieved or concerned when Isabel yanked her bike over the pile of stone and leaned it against the tree. Already there was no barrier between her property and the road anymore. Isabel looked beautiful, even with her face pink from the exertion of riding her bicycle and shiny with perspiration. Glossy blonde waves framed her face. Her faded red dress clung to her body in all the right places. The soldiers stopped to stare at her. The rolled-up Aubusson rug from the living room slung between them. Beck removed his military cap. He said something to the soldiers, who were carrying the rolled-up carpet, and they hurried toward the lorry. "You've torn down our wall," Isabel said. "The Sturmbannführer wants to be able to see all houses from the road. Somebody is distributing anti-German propaganda. We will find and arrest him." "You think harmless pieces of paper are worth all of this?" Isabel asked. "They are far from harmless, mademoiselle. They encourage terrorism." "Terrorism must be avoided," Isabel said, crossing her arms. Vianne couldn't look away from Isabel. There was something going on. Her sister seemed to be drawing her emotions back, going still, like a cat preparing to pounce. "Herr Capitan," Isabel said after a while. "Oui, mademoiselle?" Soldiers walked past them, carrying out the breakfast table. Isabel let them pass and then walked to the captain. "My papa is ill." "He is?" Vianne said. "Why don't I know this? What's wrong with him?" Isabel ignored Vianne. "He has asked that I come to Paris to nurse him, but..." "He wants you to nurse him?" Vianne said, incredulous. Beck said, "You need a travel pass to leave, mademoiselle. You know this." "I know this," Isabel seemed to barely breathe. "I thought perhaps you would procure one for me. You are a family man. Certainly you understand how important it is to answer a father's call." Strangely, as Isabel spoke, the captain turned slightly to look at Vianne, as if she were the one who mattered. "I could get you a pass, oui," the captain said, "for a family emergency such as this." "I am grateful," Isabel said. Vianne was stunned. Did Beck not see how her sister was manipulating him? And why had he looked at Vianne when making his decision? As soon as Isabel got what she wanted, she returned to her bicycle. She took hold of the handlebars and walked it toward the barn. The rubber wheels bumped and thumped on the uneven ground. Vianne rushed after her. "Papa's ill," she said when she caught up with her sister. "Papa's fine." "You lied? Why?" Isabel's pause was slight but perceptible. "I suppose there is no reason to lie. It's all out in the open now. I have been sneaking out on Friday mornings to meet Henri, and now he has asked me to go to Paris with him. He has a lovely little pied-à-terre in the Montmartre, apparently." "Are you mad?" "I'm in love, I think. A little, maybe." "You are going to cross Nazi-occupied France to spend a few nights in Paris in the bed of a man whom you might love? A little?" "I know," Isabel said. "It's so romantic. You must be feverish. Perhaps you have a brain sickness of some kind." She put her hands on her hips and made a huff of disapproval. "If love is a disease, I suppose I'm infected." "Good God, Vian crossed her arms. Is there anything I can say to stop this foolishness? Isabel looked at her. You believe me? You believe I would cross Nazi-occupied France on a lark? This is not like running away to see the circus, Isabel. But you believe this of me? Of course, Vian shrugged. So foolish. Isabel looked oddly crestfallen. Just stay away from Beck while I'm gone. Don't trust him. Isn't that just like you? You're worried enough to warn me, but not worried enough to stay with me. What you want is what really matters. Sophie and I can rot for all you care. That's not true. Isn't it? Go to Paris. Have your fun. But don't for one minute forget that you are abandoning your niece and me. Vian crossed her arms and glanced back at the man in her yard, who was supervising the looting of her house. With him. Chapter 14. April 27, 1995, the Oregon coast. I am trussed up like a chicken for roasting. I know these Marden seatbelts are a good thing, but they make me feel claustrophobic. I belong to a generation that didn't expect to be protected from every danger. I remember what it used to be like, back in the days when one was required to make smart choices. We knew the risks and took them anyway. I remember driving too fast in my old Chevrolet, my foot pressed hard on the gas, smoking a cigarette and listening to Price sing "Laudy Miss Claudy" through small black speakers while children rolled around in the back seat like bowling pins. My son is afraid that I will make a break for it, I suppose, and it is a reasonable fear. In the past month, my entire life has been turned upside down. There is a sold sign in my front yard, and I am leaving home. It's a pretty driveway, don't you think, my son says. It's what he does. He fills space with words, and he chooses them carefully. It is what makes him a good surgeon. Precision. Yes, he turns into the parking lot. Like the driveway, it is lined in flowering trees. Tiny white blossoms drop to the ground like bits of lace on a dressmaker's floor, stark against the black asphalt. I fumble with my seatbelt as we park. My hands do not obey my will these days. It frustrates me so much that I curse out loud. I'll do that, my son says, reaching sideways to unhook my seatbelt. He is out of the automobile and at my door before I have even retrieved my handbag. The door opens. He takes me by the hand and helps me out of the car. In the short distance between the parking lot and the entrance, I have to stop twice to catch my breath. The trees are so pretty this time of year, he says, as we walk together across the parking lot. Yes, they are flowering plum trees, gorgeous and pink, but I think suddenly of chestnut trees in bloom along the Champs-Élysées. My son tightens his hold on my hand. It is a reminder that he understands the pain of leaving a home that has been my sanctuary for nearly 50 years. But now it is time to look ahead, not behind, to the Ocean Crest Retirement Community and Nursing Home. To be fair, it doesn't look like a bad place, a little industrial maybe, with its rigidly upright windows and perfectly maintained patch of grass out front, and the American flag flying above the door. It is a long, low building, built in the 70s, I'd guess, back when just about everything was ugly. There are two wings that reach out from a central courtyard, where I imagine old people sit in wheelchairs with their faces turned to the sun, waiting. Thank God, I am not housed in the east side of the building, the nursing home wing. Not yet, anyway. I can still manage my own life, thank you very much, and my own apartment. Julian opens the door for me and I go inside. The first thing I see is a large reception area, decorated to look like the hospitality desk of a seaside hotel, complete with a fishing net full of shells hung on the wall. I imagine that at Christmas they hang ornaments from the netting and stockings from the edge of the desk. There are probably sparkly ho-ho-ho signs tacked up to the wall on the day after Thanksgiving. Come on, Mom. Oh, right. Mustn't dawdle. The place smells of what? Tapioca pudding and chicken noodle soup? Soft foods. Somehow I keep going. If there's one thing I never do, it's stop. Here we are, my son says, opening the door to room 317A. It's nice, honestly. A small one-bedroom apartment. The kitchen is tucked into the corner by the door, and from it one can look out over a formica counter and see a dining table with four chairs and the living room. where a coffee table and sofa and two chairs are gathered around a gas fireplace. The TV in the corner is brand new, with a built-in VCR player. Someone, my son probably, has stacked a bunch of my favorite movies in the bookcase. Jean de la Florette, Breathless, Gone with the Wind. I see my things, an Afghan I knitted thrown over the sofa's back, my books in the bookcase. In the bedroom, which is of a fine size, the nightstand on my side of the bed is lined with prescription pill containers, a little jungle of plastic orange cylinders. My side of the bed. It's funny, but some things don't change after the death of a spouse, and that's one of them. The left side of the bed is mine, even though I am alone in it. At the foot of the bed is my trunk, just as I have requested. You could still change your mind, he says quietly. Come home with me. We've talked about this, Julian. Your life is too busy. You needn't worry about me 24/7. Do you think I will worry less when you are here? I look at him. Loving this child of mine and knowing my death will devastate him. I don't want him to watch me die by degrees. I don't want that for his daughters either. I know what it is like. Some images, one scene, can never be forgotten. I want them to remember me as I am, not as I will be when the cancer has had its way. He leads me into the small living room and gets me settled on the couch. While I wait, he pours us some wine and then sits beside me. I am thinking of how it will feel when he leaves, and I am sure the same thought occupies his mind. With a sigh, he reaches into his briefcase and pulls out a stack of envelopes. The sigh is in place of words, a breath of transition. In it, I hear that moment where I go from one life to another. In this new, pared-down version of my life, I am to be cared for by my son instead of vice versa. It's not really comfortable for either of us. I've paid this month's bills. These are things I don't know what to do with. Junk mostly, I think. I take the stack of letters from him and shuffle through them. A personalized letter from the Special Olympics Committee, a free estimate awning offer, a notice from my dentist that it has been 6 months since my last appointment, a letter from Paris. There are red markings on it, as if the post office has shuffled it around from place to place or delivered it incorrectly. Mom, Julian says, he's so observant, he misses nothing. What is that? When he reaches for the envelope, I mean to hold on to it, keep it from him, but my fingers don't obey my will. My heartbeat is going all which away. Julian opens the envelope, extracts an écru card, an invitation. It's in French, he says, something about the Croix de Guerre. So it's about World War II? Is this for Dad? Of course. Men always think war is about them. And there's something handwritten in the corner. What is it? Guerre. The word expands around me, unfolds its black crow wings, becoming so big I cannot look away. Against my will, I take up the invitation. It is to a Passeuse reunion in Paris. They want me to attend. How can I possibly go without remembering all of it? The terrible things I have done, the secret I kept, the man I killed, and the one I should have. Mom, what's a passeur? I can hardly find enough voice to say, it's someone who helped people in the war. Chapter 15. Asking yourself a question, that's how resistance begins, and then ask that very question to someone else. Remco Campère. May 1941, France. On the Monday, Isabel left for Paris. Vianne kept busy. She washed clothes and hung them out to dry. She weeded her garden and gathered a few early ripening vegetables. At the end of a long day, she treated herself to a bath and washed her hair. She was drying it with a towel when she heard a knock at the door. Startled by an unexpected guest, she buttoned her bodice as she went to the door. Water dripped onto her shoulders. When she opened the door, she found Captain Beck standing there, dressed in his field uniform, dust peppering his face. Herr Capitaine, she said, pushing the wet hair away from her face. Madame, he said, a colleague and I went fishing today. I have brought you what we caught. Fresh fish? How lovely. I will fry it up for you. For us, madame, you and me and Sophie. Vianne couldn't look away from either Beck or the fish in his hands. She knew without a doubt that Isabel wouldn't accept this gift. just as she knew that her friends and neighbors would claim to turn it down. Food from the enemy. It was a matter of pride to turn it down. Everyone knew that. I have neither stolen nor demanded it. No Frenchman has more of a right to it than I. There can be no dishonor in your taking it. He was right. This was a fish from local waters. He had not confiscated it. Even as she reached for the fish, she felt the weight of rationalization settle heavily upon her. You rarely do us the honor of eating with us. It is different now, he said, with your sister away. Vianne backed into the house to allow him entry. As always, he removed his hat as soon as he stepped inside and clomped across the wooden floor to his room. Vianne didn't notice until she heard the click shut of his door that she was still standing there holding a dead fish wrapped in a recent edition of Le Paris Zeitung, the German newspaper printed in Paris. She returned to the kitchen. When she laid the paper-wrapped fish out on the butcher block, she saw that he'd already cleaned the fish, even going so far as to shave off the scales. She lit the gas stove and put a cast-iron pan over the heat, adding a precious spoonful of oil to the pan. While cubes of potato browned and onion caramelized, she seasoned the fish with salt and pepper and set it aside. In no time, tantalizing aromas filled the house, and Sophie came running into the kitchen, skidding to a stop in the empty space where the breakfast table used to be. Fish, she said with reverence. Vianne used her spoon to create a well within the vegetables and put the fish in the middle to fry. Tiny bits of grease popped up. The skin sizzled and turned crisp. At the very end, she placed a few preserved lemons in the pan, watching them melt over everything. Go tell Captain Beck that supper is ready. He is eating with us? Tante Isabel would have something to say about that. Before she left, she told me to never look him in the eye and to try not to be in the same room with him. Vianne sighed. The ghost of her sister lingered. He brought us the fish, Sophie, and he lives here. Oui, maman, I know that. Still, she said, go call the captain for supper. Isabel is gone, and with her extreme worries. Now, go. Vianne returned to the stove. Moments later, she carried out a heavy ceramic tray bearing the fried fish, surrounded by the pan-roasted vegetables and preserved lemons, all of it enhanced with fresh parsley. The tangy, lemony sauce in the bottom of the pan, swimming with crusty brown bits, could have benefited from butter, but still it smelled heavenly. She carried it into the dining room and found Sophie already seated, with Captain Beck beside her, in Antoine's chair. Vianne missed a step. Beck rose politely and moved quickly to pull out her chair. She paused only slightly as he took the platter from her. This looks most becoming, he said in a hearty voice. Once again, his French was not quite right. Vianne sat down and scooted into her place at the table. Before she could think of what to say, Beck was pouring her wine. A lovely 37 Montrachet, he said. Vianne knew what Isabel would say to that. Beck sat across from her. Sophie sat to her left. She was talking about something that had happened at school today. When she paused, Beck said something about fishing, and Sophie laughed, and Vianne felt Isabel's absence as keenly as she'd previously felt her presence. Stay away from Beck. Vianne heard the warning as clearly as if it had been spoken aloud beside her. She knew that in this one thing her sister was right. Vianne couldn't forget the list after all, and the firings, or the sight of Beck seated at his desk with crates of food at his feet, and a painting of the Führer behind him. My wife quite despaired of my skill with the net after that, he was saying, smiling. Sophie laughed. My papa fell into the river one time when we were fishing. Remember, maman? He said the fish was so big it pulled him in. Right, maman? Vianne blinked slowly. It took her a moment to notice that the conversation had circled back to include her. It felt odd, to say the least. In all their past meals, with Beck at the table, conversation had been rare. Who could speak surrounded by Isabel's obvious anger? It is different now with his sister away. Vianne understood what he meant. The tension in the house, at this table, was gone now. What other changes would her absence bring? Stay away from Beck. How was Vianne to do that? And when was the last time she'd eaten a meal this good, or heard Sophie laugh? The Gare de Lyon was full of German soldiers when Isabel disembarked from the train carriage. She wrestled her bicycle out with her. It wasn't easy with her valise banging into her thighs the whole time and impatient Parisians shoving at her. She had dreamed of coming back here for months. In her dreams, Paris was Paris, untouched by the war. But on this Monday afternoon, after a long day's travel, she saw the truth. The occupation might have left the buildings in place, and there was no evidence outside the Gare de Lyon of bombings, but there was a darkness here, even in the full light of day, a hush of loss and despair as she rode her bicycle down the boulevard. Her beloved city was like a once beautiful courtesan, grown old and thin, weary, abandoned by her lovers. In less than a year, this magnificent city had been stripped of its essence by the endless clatter of German jackboots on the streets and disfigured by swastikas that flew from every monument. The only cars she saw were black Mercedes-Benzes with miniature swastika flags flapping from prongs on the fenders, and Wehrmacht lorries, and now and then a gray panzer tank, all up and down the boulevard. Windows were blacked out and shutters were drawn. At every other corner, it seemed, her way was barricaded. Signs in bold black lettering offered directions in German, and the clocks had been changed to run 2 hours ahead, on German time. She kept her head down as she pedaled past pods of German soldiers and sidewalk cafes hosting uniformed men. As she rounded onto the Boulevard de la Bastille, she saw an old woman on a bicycle trying to bypass a barricade. A Nazi stood in her way, berating her in German, a language she obviously didn't understand. The woman turned her bicycle and pedaled away. It took Isabel longer to reach the bookshop than it should have, and by the time she coasted to a stop out front, her nerves were taut. She leaned her bicycle against a tree and locked it in place. Clutching her valise in sweaty, gloved hands, she approached the bookshop. In a bistro window, she caught sight of herself, blonde hair hacked unevenly along the bottom, face pale with bright red lips, the only cosmetic she still had. She had worn her best ensemble for traveling, a navy and cream plaid jacket with a matching hat and a navy skirt. Her gloves were a bit the worse for wear, but in these times no one noticed a thing like that. She wanted to look her best to impress her father, grown up. How many times in her life had she agonized over her hair and clothing before coming home to the Paris apartment only to discover that Papa was gone and Vianne was too busy to return from the country and that some female friend of her father's would care for Isabel while she was on holiday. Enough so that by the time she was 14, she'd stopped coming home on holidays at all. It was better to sit alone in her empty dormitory room than be shuffled among people who didn't know what to do with her. This was different, though. Henri and Didier and their mysterious friends in the Free French needed Isabel to live in Paris. She would not let them down. The bookshop's display windows were blacked out, and the grates that protected the glass during the day were drawn down and locked in place. She tried the door and found it locked. On a Monday afternoon at 4 o'clock, she went to the crevice in the store facade that had always been her father's hiding place and found the rusted skeleton key and let herself in. The narrow store seemed to hold its breath in the darkness. Not a sound came at her, not her father turning the pages of a beloved novel or the sound of his pen scratching on paper as he struggled with the poetry that had been his passion when Maman was still alive. She closed the door behind her and flicked on the light switch by the door. Nothing. She felt her way to the desk and found a candle in an old brass holder. An extended search of the drawers revealed matches, and she lit the candle. The light, meager as it was, revealed destruction in every corner of the shop. Half of the shelves were empty, many of them broken and hanging on slants. The books, a fallen pyramid on the floor beneath the low end. Posters had been ripped down and defaced. It was as if marauders had gone through on a rampage looking for something hidden and carelessly destroyed everything along the way. Papa. Isabel left the bookshop quickly, not even bothering to replace the key. Instead, she dropped it in her jacket pocket and unlocked her bicycle and climbed aboard. She kept to the smallest streets, the few that weren't barricaded, until she came to Rue de Grenelle. There she turned and pedaled for home. The apartment on the Avenue de la Bourdonnaye had been in her father's family for more than 100 years. The city street was lined on either side by pale sandstone buildings with black ironwork balconies and slate roofs. Carved stone cherubs decorated the cornices. About six blocks away, the Eiffel Tower rose high into the sky, dominating the view. On the street level were dozens of storefronts with pretty awnings and cafes, with tables set up out front. The high floors were all residential. Usually, Isabel walked slowly along the sidewalk, window shopping, appreciating the hustle and bustle around her. Not today. The cafes and bistros were empty. Women in worn clothes and tired expressions stood in queues for food. She stared up at the blacked-out windows as she fished the key from her bag. Opening the door, she pushed her way into the shadowy lobby, hauling a bicycle with her. She locked it to a pipe in the lobby, ignoring the coffin-sized cage elevator, which no doubt didn't run in these days of limited electricity. She climbed the narrow, steeply pitched stairs that coiled around the elevator shaft and came to the fifth-floor landing, where there were two doors, one on the left side of the building and theirs on the right. She unlocked the door and stepped inside. Behind her, she thought she heard the neighbor's door open. When she turned back to say hello to Madame Leclerc, the door clicked quietly shut. Apparently, the nosy old woman was watching the comings and goings in apartment 6B. She entered her apartment and closed the door behind her. "Papa?" Even though it was midday, the blacked-out windows made it dark inside. "Papa?" There was no answer. Truthfully, she was relieved. She carried her valise into the salon. The darkness reminded her of another time, long ago. The apartment had been shadowy and musty. There had been breathing then, and footsteps creaking on wooden floors. "Hush, Isabel. No talking. Your maman is with the angels now." She turned on the light switch in the living room, and an ornate blown glass chandelier flickered to life, its sculpted glass branches glittering as if from another world. In the meager light, she looked around the apartment, noticing that several pieces of art were missing from the walls. The room reflected both her mother's unerring sense of style and the collection of antiques from other generations. Two paned windows, covered now, should have revealed a beautiful view of the Eiffel Tower from the balcony. Isabel turned off the light. There was no reason to waste precious electricity while she waited. She sat down at the round wooden table beneath the chandelier, its rough surface scarred by a thousand suppers over the years. Her hand ran lovingly over the banged-up wood. "Let me stay, Papa. Please, I'll be no trouble." How old had she been that time? 11, 12? She wasn't sure, but she'd been dressed in the blue sailor uniform of the convent school. It all felt a lifetime ago now. And yet here she was again, ready to beg him to love her, let her stay. Later, how much longer? She wasn't sure how long she'd sat here in the dark, remembering the circumstances of her mother because she had all but forgotten her face in any real way. She heard footsteps and then a key rattling in the lock. She heard the door open and rose to her feet. The door clicked shut. She heard him shuffling through the entry, past the small kitchen. She needed to be strong now, determined, but the courage that was as much a part of her as the green of her eyes had always faded in her father's presence, and it retreated now. "Papa," she said into the darkness. She knew he hated surprises. She heard him go still. Then a light switch clicked and the chandelier came on. "Isabel," he said with a sigh, "what are you doing here?" She knew better than to reveal uncertainty to this man who cared so little for her feelings. She had a job to do now. "I have come to live with you in Paris. Again," she added as an afterthought. "You left Vianne and Sophie alone with the Nazi?" "They are safer with me gone, believe me. Sooner or later I would have lost my temper." "Lost your temper? What is wrong with you? You will return to Caravaux tomorrow morning." He walked past her to the wooden sideboard that was tucked against the papered wall. He poured himself a glass of brandy, drank it down in three large gulps, and poured another. When he finished the second drink, he turned to her. "No," she said. The single word galvanized her. Had she ever said it to him before? She said it again for good measure. "No. Pardon?" I said, "No, Papa, I will not bend to your will this time. I will not leave. This is my home, my home." Her voice weakened on that. "Those are the drapes I watched Maman make on her sewing machine. This is the table she inherited from her great uncle. On the walls of my bedroom, you'll find my initials drawn in Maman's lipstick when she wasn't looking. In my secret room, my fort, I'll bet my dolls are still lined up along the walls. Isabel, no, you will not turn me away, Papa. You have done that too many times. You are my father. This is my home. We are at war. I'm staying." She bent down for the valise at her feet and picked it up. In the pale glow of the chandelier, she saw defeat deepen the lines in her father's cheeks. His shoulders slumped. He poured himself another brandy, gulped it greedily. Obviously, he could barely stand to look at her without the aid of alcohol. "There are no parties to attend," he said, "and all your university boys are gone." "This is really what you think of me?" she said. Then she changed the subject. "I stopped by the bookshop." "The Nazis," he said in response. "They stormed in one day and pulled out everything by Freud, Mann, Trotsky, Tolstoy, Marois. All of them they burned, and the music too. I would rather lock the doors than sell only what I am allowed to. So I did just that." "So how are you making a living? Your poetry?" He laughed. It was a bitter, slurred sound. "This is hardly a time for gentler pursuits." "Then how are you paying for electricity and food?" Something changed in his face. "I've got a good job at the Hotel de Crillon." In service? She could hardly credit him serving beer to German brutes. He glanced away. Isabel got a sick feeling in her stomach. "For whom do you work, Papa?" "The German high command in Paris," he said. Isabel recognized that feeling now. It was shame. "After what they did to you in the Great War?" "Isabel, I remember the stories Maman told us about how you'd been before the war and how it had broken you. I used to dream that some day you'd remember that you were a father. But all that was a lie, wasn't it? You're just a coward. The minute the Nazis return, you race to aid them. How dare you judge me in what I've been through? You're 18 years old." 19, she said. "Tell me, Papa, do you get our conquerors coffee or hail them taxis on their way to Maxime's? Do you eat their lunch leftovers?" He seemed to deflate before her eyes. Age. She felt unaccountably regretful for her sharp words, even though they were true and deserved. But she couldn't back down now. "So we are agreed. I will move into my old room and live here. We need barely speak if that is your condition." "There is no food here in the city, Isabel, nor for us Parisians, anyway. All over town are signs warning us not to eat rats, and these signs are necessary. People are raising guinea pigs for food. You will be more comfortable in the country, where there are gardens." "I am not looking for comfort or safety." "What are you looking for in Paris, then?" She realized her mistake. She'd set a trap with her foolish words and stepped right into it. Her father was many things. Stupid was not one of them. "I'm here to meet a friend." "Tell me we are not talking about some boy. Tell me you are smarter than that." "The country was dull, Papa. You know me." He sighed, pouring another drink from the bottle. She saw the telltale glaze come into his eyes. Soon, she knew, he would stumble away to be alone with whatever it was he thought about. "If you stay, there will be rules." "Rules?" "You will be home by curfew, always and without exception. You will leave me my privacy. I can't stomach being hovered over. You will go to the shops each morning and see what our ration cards will get us, and you will find a job." He paused, looking at her, his eyes narrowed. "And if you get yourself in trouble, like your sister did, I will throw you out, period." "I am not..." "I don't care. A job, Isabel. Find one." He was still talking when she turned on a heel and walked away. She went into her old bedroom and shut the door. Hard. She had done it. For once, she'd gotten her way. Who cared that he'd been mean and judgmental? She was here, in her bedroom, in Paris, and staying. The room was smaller than she remembered, painted a cheery white with a twin iron-canopied bed and a faded old rug on the wooden plank floor, and a Louis XV armchair that had seen better days. The window, blacked out, overlooked the interior courtyard of the apartment building. As a girl, she'd always known when her neighbors were taking out the trash because she could hear them clanking out there, slamming down lids. She tossed her valise on the bed and began to unpack. The clothes she'd taken on Exodus and returned to Paris with were shabbier for the constant wear and hardly worth hanging in the armoire, along with the clothes she'd inherited from her maman. Beautiful vintage flapper dresses with flared skirts, silk-fringed evening gowns, woolen suits that had been cut down to fit her, and the crepe day dresses, an array of matching hats and shoes made for dancing on ballroom floors or walking through the Rodin gardens with the right boy on one's arms. Clothes were for a world that had vanished. There were no more right boys in Paris. There were practically no boys at all. They were all captive in camps in Germany or hiding out somewhere. When her clothes were returned to hangers in the armoire, she closed the mahogany doors and pushed the armoire sideways just enough to reveal the secret door behind it, her fort. She bent down and opened the door set into the white paneled wall by pushing on the top right corner. It sprang free, creaked open, revealing a storage room about 6 feet by 6 feet, with a roof so slanted that even as a 10-year-old girl she'd had to hunch over to stand in it. Sure enough, her dolls were still in there, some slumped and others standing tall. Isabel closed the door on her memories and moved the armoire back in place. She undressed quickly and slipped into a pink silk dressing gown that reminded her of her maman. It still smelled vaguely of rose water, or she pretended it did. As she headed out of the room to brush her teeth, she paused at her father's closed door. She could hear him writing, his fountain pen scratched on rough paper. Every now and then he cursed and then fell silent. That was when he was drinking, no doubt. Then came the thunk of a bottle, or a fist, on the table. Isabel readied for bed, setting her hair in curlers and washing her face and brushing her teeth. On her way back to bed, she heard her father curse again, louder this time, maybe drinking, and she ducked into a bedroom and slammed the door behind her. "I can't stomach being hovered over." Apparently, what this really meant was that her father couldn't stand to be in the same room with her. Funny that she hadn't noticed it last year when she'd lived with him for those weeks between her expulsion from the finishing school and her exile to the country. True, they'd never sat down to a meal together then or had a conversation meaningful enough to remember. But somehow she hadn't noticed. They'd been together in the bookshop, working side by side. Had she been so pathetically grateful for his presence that his silence escaped her notice? Well, she noticed it now. He pounded on her bedroom door so hard she released a little yelp of surprise. "I'm leaving for work," her father said through the door. "The ration cards are on the counter. I left you 100 francs. Get what you can." She heard his footsteps echo down the wooden hall, heavy enough to rattle the walls. Then the door slammed shut. "Goodbye to you, too," Isabel mumbled, stung by the tone of his voice. Then she remembered. Today was the day. She threw back the coverlet, climbed out of bed, and dressed without bothering to turn on the light. She had already planned her outfit. A drab gray dress and black beret, white gloves, and her last pair of black slingback pumps. Sadly, she had no stockings. She studied herself in the salon mirror, trying to be critical, but all she saw was an ordinary girl in a dull dress carrying a black handbag. She opened her handbag again and stared down at the silk hammock-like lined interior. She had slit a tiny opening in the lining and slipped the thick envelope inside of it. Upon opening the handbag, it looked empty. Even if she did get stopped, which she wouldn't, why would she? A 19-year-old girl dressed for lunch? They would see nothing in her handbag except her papers, her ration coupons, and her carte d'identité, certificate of domicile, and her Ausweis, exactly what should be there. At 10 o'clock, she left the apartment. Outside, beneath a bright, hot sun, she climbed aboard her blue bicycle and pedaled toward the quay. When she reached the Rue de Rivoli, black cars and green military lorries with fuel tanks strapped onto their sides and men on horseback filled the street. There were Parisians about, walking along the sidewalks, pedaling down the few streets upon which they were allowed to ride, queuing for food in lines that extended down the block. They were noticeable by the look of defeat on their faces and the way they hurried past the Germans without making eye contact. At Maxime's restaurant, beneath the famous red awning, she saw a cluster of high-ranking Nazis waiting to get inside. The rumor was rampant that all of the country's best meats and produce went straight to Maxime's to be served to the high command. And then she spotted it, the iron bench near the entrance to the Comédie Française. Isabelle hit the brakes on her bicycle and came to a bumpy sudden stop, then stepped off the pedal with one foot. Her ankle gave a little twist when she put weight on it. For the first time, her excitement turned a little sharp with fear. Her handbag felt heavy suddenly, noticeably so. Sweat collected in her palms and along the rim of her felt hat. Snap out of it. She was a courier, not a frightened schoolgirl. What risk there was, she accepted. We have come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.